We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show. We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Meditation Studio. I'm Patricia Karpus. In this series, we introduce you to real people with extraordinary stories and experts who share how meditation and mindfulness practices change our lives. Our podcast is brought to you by Meditation Studio, Apple's pick as one of the 10 best apps of the year. Why download the app? Because life is messy. We get stressed, anxious, have trouble sleeping, we work too hard, we deal with conflict, our hearts get broken, we worry about the state of the world. We meditate because we're human. Our app gives you hundreds of meditations from over 30 leading experts. It helps a lot. And if you haven't tried the app yet, you can now try it for free and explore starter series plus a sample of some of our favorite guided meditations in the Discover collection. You may also want to check out our new meditation collections this year. Mindful eating, work, authentic leadership, and a special collection just for college students. There's also a new mindful work and sleep basics course. If you've already got the app, check out our new unguided meditation timer where you can create your own meditations with or without our brand new, pretty amazing music tracks. And don't forget the 8 free meditations on Alexa. Just ask her to enable Meditation Studio. Today's guest is Ben Fetter, author of the new book, Take Off Your Shoes, One Man's Journey from the Boardroom to Bali and Back. Ben was and still is a successful, pretty hard-charging New York City executive. Hoping to reconnect with his family and with his own sense of purpose, he jumped off the treadmill a few years ago to take a sabbatical in Bali with the whole family. In the book and in this interview, he shares what he learned from the journey, how he found his own center through meditation, art, and the overall pace and culture of Bali, and how his entire family was transformed by this unique, fun, and courageous experience. Now, here's Ben. Ben, it is such an honor to have you on Untangle today. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really nice to be here.
Yeah. So I loved reading your book, and it was so inspiring on a number of different levels. And I wanted you to kind of start by giving us some background on what inspired you to even write this book and to tell this story.
I thought it was a unique experience, and I had a story to tell. I never had my life story until then had been, I'd say, middle of the road kind of guy with a career, doing the best he can kind of thing. And then something changed in my 40s and kind of I did something extraordinary. So I had a story to tell. More importantly, all my friends and people who heard the story sort of said, you know, you should write a book about this because other people can learn from it. Mostly it was for my children. I started writing it because I wanted my children to know what was going through my mind about why I left kind of an exciting career to go do this with them. And I wanted them to understand what was going on inside my head. And I figured it wouldn't matter to them when they were kids, but sometimes in their 20s or 30s, when kids begin to start asking questions about their parents, I wanted them to have kind of a complete answer. And while it was still fresh in my mind, so I began to write.
Tell us a little bit about your life before the sabbatical. Your life in New York City is sort of a, what you might call a hard driving business guy. What was your life like and what inspired you to take the sabbatical to begin with?
Yeah, I think hard driving business guy is not a bad description. I had led a takeover of a public company in more or less a hostile way, and took over as the CEO of the company in a turnaround. And it was a company with global operations. And I would circle the globe any number of times per year, trying to organize the business, setting it up for success. And I realized that as I was doing that, my kids were growing up and I was becoming the father and husband that I had never intended to be. And so at some point I kind of looked in the mirror, and there was a moment in the book that I describe about these everyday moments that we never think mean anything and just somehow it lights something up in our minds.
Yeah.
And this was one of those moments where I just kind of saw my oldest son who was going into high school. I saw him barricaded inside his room, sequestered, doing his homework. And he's always had his head down. He's always wanted to be a good student and go to a good college.
This is Sam.
This is Sam. All of a sudden, I had this moment of realization that he's going to be doing that for his high school career, and I'm going to be doing the traveling for my professional career. And then he's going to go to college, and then he's going to go to the club his whole life, and then it'll be all over.
Yeah.
And so I just had this now or never moment. It's like, that old expression, are we working to live or living to work? And I don't know, it was just a bit of an epiphany. It was a simple moment, but it was a bit of an epiphany for me.
In the book, you talk about coming home late for dinner, sometimes not showing up, or everybody being at dinner and kind of being tense. And did you have an outlet for relaxing before your sabbatical, or would you say you were just kind of a busy person and your family was busy?
I don't want to overstate the case about being out of control busy. We went on vacations. I spent time with my wife. I had dinner with them. But I had this overarching experience that my day-to-day life was diverging from their day-to-day lives, right?
Right,
I was very often traveling international. And in a positive way too, right? I was experiencing all these great things I mean, very often in that job, it's like I look myself in the mirror. It's like, I get to do this. Like, what an amazing thing that I get to do this kind of work and see these kinds of things, meet all these people. But I wasn't sharing it with my family. We weren't having shared experiences.
Right.
But in terms of relaxation, I exercised like crazy. We went on vacations. I did go to dinners, but very often I was not home for dinner. I had like the breakfast meeting, the lunch meeting, the dinner meeting. You know, on the sidebar, you start putting on weight by doing all that stuff. You have to a lot of relationships, a lot of dinners.
Yeah.
And so, well, you know, I needed to get my body back too. So.
But you really loved your job, and you loved your family. And
I loved the company. I loved the people I was working with.
Exactly. Like you talked a lot about that. So what was it like when you actually decided to go on the sabbatical for a year? You and your wife, Victoria, talked a lot about it. And then you made the decision to go to Bali. And then you had to introduce this idea to your children, some of whom were in high school, which is kind of hard to leave sometimes. So what was that whole process like for you?
It was a long process, honestly. I mean, it was a long, long time of planning and figuring out how we're going to do this, how we're going to educate ourselves. Any family is rooted in what they're doing. It's very hard to just pick yourself up one day and get on an airplane. So in the background and thinking about it, even before you actually make the decision, it was probably a year and a half before we actually got to a place where we can sort of say, okay, let's do this. I kind of thought I have four kids. My oldest kid would have the hardest time and my youngest kid would have the easiest time. As it turns out, it was the opposite. My oldest kid had the hardest time accepting the news, but the easiest time once he was there. And my youngest had the easiest time accepting the news and the hardest time when she was there. We told them one at a time. We told my oldest son first. And I remember he just like sat there dumbfounded and couldn't even speak. And it was like a day and a half before he spoke to us again.
Wow.
And then somehow it kind of dawned on him that maybe this could be a little vacation from the high-pressure New York City schools. Because he started asking questions like, where are we going? And Bali wasn't our original destination either, and sort of, you know, all sorts of questions about it. But eventually they all came around. And for my wife and I, it was just pure liberation. I mean, can you imagine, and your listeners can imagine, it's kind of everybody's in their own lives and their routines and this and that. And all of a sudden, you kind of decide to take on this adventure, and you kind of realize, wait, we're gonna leave this behind, and we're gonna travel the world for an extended period of time, and go live in an exotic place, and just like all of that possibility and adventures really just brightens your mind. It's actually a very, very exciting time. At the same time, it's a very tense time at work because A, I love the company, and B, I kind of realized I'd probably end up having to walk away from it permanently. It wasn't the kind of position and the kind of relationships that I had where everybody says, yeah, sure, disappear for a year and come back.
Right.
So I realized from the beginning that that was always a possibility.
Yeah, I mean, it was a very courageous decision to take you and your family out of your life and into a completely different world and culture. And you eventually decided on Bali, which turned out to be a really great decision.
Bali is just such a magical place.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. My wife and I disagree about this. She would say wherever we would have ended up, we would have had an amazing experience. It happened to have been Bali, so we had an amazing experience there.
Right.
I'm not sure I agree. I think Bali is a very special place on the planet. I think it's before the volcanoes, it was being overrun by tourists, and I was a little concerned it was getting a little overdone. It's quieted down somewhat since then. Yeah. Not to be the Minister of Communication for Bali, but the truth is there are parts of Bali that are not beautiful. There's parts of Bali that are really gritty and really third world-like. And we used to describe when we were there, it's like third world-like because there's wonderful ways for Westerners to live there. But I think Bali is one of the... There are parts of Bali that are absolutely beautiful. It's more the culture and the people that are really beautiful. I think the Balinese just walk around with smiles all day long. They're wonderful. And it's one of the last kind of intact indigenous cultures on the planet that hasn't been completely westernized or kind of polluted by Western ideas. It's an amazing place.
So you pick up your family, you land in Bali. I know you had some stops along the way, but what was it like when you first, so being someone that worked full-time and had a pretty routine life already, and here you were dropped into this new place. What was it like for you personally to adapt to some of the quiet time or not knowing exactly what you were going to do when you woke up every morning?
The truth is,
we'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, take comfort in Born Shoes. Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.
It was imagining what that would be was the hardest part. I was in New York, and I was like, I kept going to my wife, Victoria. I was like, what am I going to do? Any urban professional has a lot of stimulation coming at them all the time. And then you can imagine being head of a large public company. There is all that much more stimulation coming at you all the time. And it took a while, actually, to kind of get used to it. And I would say it took probably 6 to 8 weeks just for my head to clear about all the things that I'd be thinking about in New York. And so it took that much longer. But I find that your activities fill the time that you have. And so things just slowed down.
Right.
And so I was never bored. It's just you'd look in your watch. It's like, well, is it 2 o'clock already? We did get into a routine ultimately. And it involved a lot of yoga, a lot of art, a lot of socializing. Our kids ended up at an amazing school there called the Green School. And it's a school dedicated to environmental studies and really just joy of learning. It's a beautiful campus in the middle of the jungle. And it just nothing could be farther from New York City. I mean, you can imagine anything.
Yeah, what an amazing experience.
And a lot of our lives ended up revolving around that. Green School has a lot of expat families that are attracted to it. And so it was kind of a built-in social community and made up of a lot of people like us that were professionals taking some time off for an extended period, some for 6 months and some for 6 years.
Wow. I remember in the book, you were talking about reading a lot of books by people like Jon Kabat-Zinn and Joseph Goldstein and Dan Siegel and Sharon Salzberg. And you had not meditated before you started the sabbatical, or had you meditated a little bit? I mean, what sort of piqued your interest to start meditating while you were there?
Before I went, I had picked up a book in the airport while waiting for a flight called Joyful Wisdom by Mingyur Rinpoche, who's a Buddhist monk and a meditation master. I don't know what attracted me to it, but I picked it up and it was a wonderful book, humorlessly, with a lot of humor. But really, it's kind of a guy who grows up in Nepal with what he describes as severe anxiety disorder in a world where there was lots to be anxious about. It was food and shelter, and life was very fragile there. Finds his way to his monastery and ultimately finds a way to the United States. And he arrives in the United States and sees the shopping malls and the beautiful cars and the beautiful clothing and all this stuff. And he says, wow, people here must be so happy.
Yeah, right.
And then he kind of finds out what's really going on. And it's kind of a bit of an inquiry into, like, what's all this about?
Yeah.
And it was really an inquiry in the ability to change your life by changing your mind. And at the same time, I also was interested in brain plasticity. And the two of them kind of, I was reading about that. There's also a wonderful book called The Brain That Changes Itself by Norman Deutsch. It's a wonderful introduction to brain plasticity and neuroscience. And the two of them kind of somehow came together for me and thought that, could I deal with all the emotion that goes around everybody's lives in their professional world? Can I deal with it in a different kind of way? And so I got interested in thinking if I could change neural pattern in my mind through meditation and see if I could over time do that. So I just made it one of my goals. And before I went to Bali, I made it a goal to learn how to meditate. I'd never tried it before. And I found the book describes kind of some scenes in there with a lot of false starts and what's this all about and how to do it without it being too weird.
What was that like for you? Like when you first started meditating and you'd have all these thoughts in your mind, what was that? What approach did you take to your sort of first practice and what are some of the different practices that you began exploring?
I didn't know how to do it. So I kind of went to a meditation class. It was an ashram in Bali that I went to, and that was a little too weird for me. And then there was like, I went to a Tibetan singing bowl, and it was just so foreign to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just trying to find a place. I would say today, meditation and mindful meditation has become mainstream.
Yeah.
But when I was doing this, it certainly was not. And I was really trying to find a point of entry, a portal into this world that was accessible to me. And eventually I found it because I find it the way I educate myself generally in life. And that's, I find it through books. And that's how I discovered it. And it wasn't because somebody taught me. I just ultimately, and like many things, many other skills I've learned in my life, I've self-taught and I've pursued my own interests.
You described a lot of the challenges that you had learning to meditate. And I think it's so impressive that you kept working at it, if you will, if you can say working at meditating, but you just even sticking with it. And partially because you had read so many of these books and sort of knew that it would be ultimately a benefit to you. But was there also some sort of dovetail of your meditation practice with your learning to draw? Because I thought that was really interesting. I don't think you had been an artist before your sabbatical, but you started learning how to draw from, was it the book, The Art of Drawing?
It was The Art of Drawing. The connection between the two is really the rejection of the idea that we are who we are and we're never going to change.
Yeah.
And that our brains are never going to change. And it turns out the brain is a lot more plastic than all that. And we can learn things even in middle age and old age. I mean, the brain is a lot more plastic than people think it is, a lot more flexible than people are. And anatomically, they've discovered that the physical brain actually changes by changing your thought patterns. So in the same way that I wanted to change my thought patterns and dealing with emotions and all that, I also took up a challenge of like, well, can I teach myself a brand new skill where I had like zero talent? I still believe I have zero talent. The level of my artistic talent rose to stick figures. I mean, that was it. I could do nothing. I said, well, let's try this. And so the wonderful lesson from the book that you mentioned is the notion that anybody can draw, right? The trick is to learn how to see and to see the way an artist sees. And the amazing thing, when you sort of see the world the way an artist sees the world, and she goes through a bunch of exercises about how to do that and how to turn on the right side of your brain and quiet the left side of the brain, the right side of the brain dealing with shapes and color and line as opposed to words and numbers. And you turn that side of your brain on, and it's amazing what opens up to you in terms of your perception of the world around you. And you realize that there are all these things that have been in front of your face the entire life, and you've never seen them. And of course, your eye has seen them, but your brain hasn't processed them. And all of a sudden, you see this, and it's just like, it's just an amazing lesson in kind of what perspective can do and perception and what, how, and a little bit of a humbling experience in terms of what do you know, what do you think you know, what do you believe? And all of a sudden, you're kind of like, well, this has been here my whole life. I never even saw it. Amazing. And so it went from there, and I started drawing today. I paint in oils. People look at my paintings like, oh, you have some amazing talent. I was like, this is all brute force. I've just taught myself a new skill.
That's pretty awesome. I mean, I completely agree that when we shift the way that we see things or we give ourselves some stillness, there's often like a little opening to see things differently.
Right.
And I love how you talk about that. And you also made the parallel. I think you had this I don't know if it was like an aha moment, but when you were doing yoga and you talked about the transition between poses and you saw that as a metaphor for space in transition, which helps you to see those transitions maybe a little bit differently. We usually move from one thing to the next really quickly. And if you look at that, like the space between two things, there's a lot that you can learn in there. And I felt like that's sort of what you were saying.
That and that the transition, that you can't go from one pose to the other, because if you mess up the transition, you mess up the before and the after too. I talk about it as being a metaphor for kind of what I did with my career. You have to set yourself up, and the transitions are really important. And creating space is important, creating positive space, creating negative space. All of that is something that I've learned through meditation.
You talk about Eric, who's your friend, who also was the founder of the Green School. And he had this quote, and I really love what he was talking about here. Through meditation and other practices, he consciously set about to develop neural connections that promoted positive emotions, personal relationships, and a sense of abundance in his life. And then you were mentioning that his mantras, notice, shift, and rewire. And if we can do that, we can cultivate the positive, and a sense of joy can permanently be etched in the brain. And you were saying then that happiness is a teachable mental skill. Will you talk about how you feel about that and how you integrate that into your own life so that you have and continue to sort of etch this ability to feel joy in your brain?
Sure. Yeah. It's totally true, by the way. And I've seen it in my own life. I mean, it starts with the aphorism in neuroscience that neurons that fire together, wire together, which means that if you have a thought that creates a small etch in your brain, that neural pattern, it gets remembered. There's kind of memory of that. And the next time you have that same thought, that etching gets a little deeper. And the next time you have the same thought, it gets deeper and deeper. Before you know it, that thought becomes this impulsive thing that you just accept to be true. Whatever that thought pattern happens to be, whether it's like, pick it, this person drives me crazy, whatever it is, but it's just kind of, right, some negative thought. I mean, both positive and negative. And before you know it, these things are deep canyons in your brain and it's impossible to get out of them. And so Eric's idea of notice, shift, rewire is in meditation, right? There's a practice of just watching your thoughts, noticing things, right? So notice your thought, then turn it around, think a different thought, consciously make yourself think a different thought. Instead of, I don't like this person, think, I really like this person, or I have compassion for this person. And the next time have that thought again, where next time we're going to have compassion for that person. Before you know it, you begin to see common humanity with that person. And so, you know, the ability to kind of consciously change your thoughts, either through meditation, but it doesn't have to be meditation. It could also be just kind of in the moment, living your life. Notice it. Don't get carried away with it. Just take a step back and notice what you're really thinking and consciously change it. Mm-hmm. And if you consciously change it to the positive, you ultimately, over time, takes a long time. Mm-hmm. Over time, I think, become a much happier person.
And is this a practice that you do in your life daily now?
All the time. So for example, one thing that's easy for me and for your listeners to do is when something positive happens in your life, if you've seen somebody you haven't seen for a long time,
My name's Dwayne Osterlin. I'm host of the Addicted Mind podcast. Are you ready to uncover the science of breaking addiction? Then join me on the Addicted Mind, where compassion meets innovation. We're going to explore real stories of addiction recovery, hear from real experts on science-based treatment, and you'll be able to equip yourself with the tools for lasting change. So whether you're on the road to recovery yourself or walking alongside someone who is, the Addicted Mind podcast is your companion. So check it out. Subscribe on whatever podcast app you're using right now and be part of the conversation that's changing lives.
A moment your kid kind of does something really cute, instead of laughing or kind of really just kind of like, hey, how's it, give a hug or something like that, pause for a second and just kind of think about that feeling. Mm-hmm. Breathe it in. Just think about it. Just pause for a second. Just like look at the person. Just like breathe that in. That in itself creates a bit of that neural connection. Like, let me take a second and enjoy that. So that doesn't require sitting on a cushion for 30 or 45 minutes. That requires about 3 seconds or less. And to continue to do that, recognize the positive, and eventually I think you have a much more positive outlook.
Yeah, we had Rick Hansen on our show who wrote the book Hardwiring Your Brain for Happiness, and that's exactly what he was suggesting. In a way, I mean, what he was saying was remember that moment and feel the feeling that you had, so you have this elevated emotion and that begins to rewire.
An emotion people, we remember things that have emotion attached to them.
Mm-hmm.
Take in the emotion and the moment, put them together, and just breathe it in.
Yeah. So how has all of this changed the way you deal with relationships now? Like when you think about, let's say, your conflict style in relationship with your spouse or conflict style in relationship with your peers, are you different, would you say, before and after this kind of transformation that you had?
We all live in this world. And
yeah, it's hard.
You know, I like Dan Harris's book, 10% Happier. I love that title because, like, it's not promising you the moon and the stars. It's like,
right.
It's just 10%, just a little bit happier. But often things that on the margin are the difference with a distinction. They're just the difference that makes a difference.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like, it's 10% better. It's not like I've changed my world. But I do stop when somebody is either a spouse or some other relationship is driving me crazy for a moment. I do stop and recognize our common humanity and the Buddhist thought that we all kind of want the same things. We all
yes.
can go about it differently, but we all kind of ultimately just want the same things. And we're all part of humanity. And in some way, humanity is just kind of one big organism. And so kind of recognize for a moment that we're kind of the same and we're looking at each other and kind of like you're looking in the mirror and he or she is just going about it in a different way. I pause for a moment, probably not in the heat of the moment because it's hard, but afterwards, just recognize that we're very few people are evil. There are some evil people, unfortunately, but very few people are kind of really evil or incompetent or anything like that. And recognize compassion. And even people that I have the most very difficult relationships with, it's actually a good exercise in terms of meditation and neural exercise to take somebody you have a really difficult time with and deliberately try to cultivate compassion for that person. There's a practice in meditation you probably know called metta meditation, where mm-hmm. there's a way of doing that. There's kind of a way of getting you to that place instead of just charging right into like, well, I hate this person, but I'm going to find compassion for him. There's a method to kind of get you to that place so you don't have to charge into it.
Yeah.
But I do find that I do charge into it sometimes. Like, okay, like, let's turn around whatever I'm thinking. Let's see if I can turn it around and think of it in a different way. And can I find compassion for that person?
Yeah.
And I think that in and of itself kind of makes you walk around this world with a happier demeanor.
Totally. And it does sound like you acquired a whole batch of new tools for, you might call, living consciously. And I think that's what's really interesting. And as I hear your story, it reminds me how much I wish that many of these tools are taught in schools. I just think that would be
yeah.
an awesome thing for kids to have tools for communication and resilience and pausing and just this idea of how do we be stronger as emotionally well people. So I love that in this year and before and after that you acquired a lot of these tools. So does that concept of living consciously, which I know you talk about in your book, has that changed for you?
I'm at a place in my practice now where I meditate practically daily. And if I don't meditate, I'm doing yoga practically daily. And so I haven't reflected on that in a while because it's just become part of my daily routine. But I do notice, somebody asked me the other day, do you notice what happens if you haven't meditated for a
mm-hmm,
day?
Mm-hmm.
One day I can get by with, but if it's 3 days or a week, I notice for sure that the way I am with other people and the way I am in my own mind is much different. It's more tense. I tell people I end up reacting to things instead of responding to things.
It's amazing that we have to keep practicing. It's not like you learn this thing or listen to one podcast. You really have to integrate right. the practice into your life.
Absolutely. This is not a spectator sport.
Yeah. Do your kids meditate? Does your wife meditate? Has it become part of your family? Or is there some other thing that you all do together that gives the kids these tools as well?
Two of my four kids have expressed an interest in meditation. The others haven't really. They're all very respectful of my practice, like if mm-hmm, I'm meditating. Mm-hmm. And we joke about it too, you know, kind of be sitting, they'll be doing something and I'll be off sitting cross-legged on a cushion with like, they'll roll their eyes a little bit. But in high school, we have some ADD people in our family and kind of watching a teenager try to sit on a cushion and try to be still is kind of funny because they're sitting, but you can tell they're not still. They're just kind of like their bodies are swaying. They're going back and forth. They're kind of like their necks are moving. They just cannot be still. They don't know how to do it. But I do notice, especially with my older daughter, that when we sit even for 10 or 15 minutes, because I don't think she can go longer than that yet, but I just know I can see her calm down and she's totally bought into it and she wants to learn more and she's really interested in it.
That's great.
So it's not for everybody. I think
yeah.
we all have to find our path and find our way. And just in the way exercise, for example, I'll like to cycle. Somebody else may like to swim. Somebody else may like to lift weights. I mean, everybody's yeah. going to find their thing. And if you try to force it down somebody who's not interested in it, just it's not going to work.
Well, I think also they say when the student is ready, the teacher appears. Everybody comes to these practices when they're ready. So looking back on this experience, and you're back in a senior level position in a pretty big company. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Right now, a big tech company in China.
Yeah.
How does it feel now? I know there's been a little bit of time. You've, of course, written the book, so there's been a lot of time between your actual sabbatical and this job right now, but how are you doing?
I thought you were going in a different direction. I'm going to answer a question you haven't asked, and then I will answer the question.
Okay, perfect.
What I notice from some of the people, some of the younger people working in China, and it's a very kind of young company, I notice a lot of stress and anxiety and like back pain. And I remember sitting down with one of the younger people in the company, and he was anxious about promotion and his job. And it's like, I was like, can we talk about that voice inside your head? How do you know what's going inside my head? I was like, because it goes inside everybody's head. But that kind of realization hasn't really dawned on somebody who's much younger than that and working in a, what I would say is a very, very hard charging company. I kind of feel like these tools are necessary. If you're going to live in that world, if you're going to live in technology world, I'm San Francisco now and Silicon Valley's full of this, right?
Yes.
People are working 80, 90 hour weeks.
Yeah.
And it's part of the culture here, especially when you're younger. And I do feel that these are critical skills to learn. And then for me, the one thing that kind of gets in the way of my practice is when I'm crossing across time zones and it's and the travel and all that stuff. It's hard to stay on a regular meditation practice. It's hard to say, right? I'm also older and everything feels just a lot more in balance for me. Mm-hmm. In a paradoxical way, I think I achieve more by being able to do that because there's so much less mental energy going into dealing with the kind of emotions I just described with this younger guy. I don't get carried away with my thoughts. I kind of, one of the practices that I talk about in the book is this practice of not believing your thoughts. They're just things, right? They're just secretions of your mind. They're not real. They don't need to be believed. They're just, I think of them as like sweat coming out of a sweat gland. It's just something your body creates and they're not facts. They're not real. And yet we get carried away with them. And for me, the whole practice of meditation is falling back for 30 minutes a day and watching this and realizing that's kind of what goes in and out of your conscious mind is temporary. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And it's just little soap bubbles that ultimately just burst and disappear, and you're on to the next one.
Yeah, I love the way you put that. That's so awesome. Have you gone on a silent retreat yet, or is that like not in your plans?
It's in my aspirations.
Yeah.
I have tried. There are two challenges for me. One is my commitment to my family, and I can't really disappear for a week. And the other is I work in a tech company, and the instant messages that just keep coming back and forth. I don't know how I would disappear into a silent retreat with all that.
Maybe the time will be right at some point. So what's next for you? So are you in what's next? You're in this job and your practice. Is there anything else that you're hoping to do in terms of expanding or enriching your practice?
The truth is, I do feel like I need a teacher. I kind of reached a point in my practice where I'm like, and I do feel like I need to go on a retreat. My practice is my practice. I think it could be more, but I don't know what that really, I can't articulate what that means, but I do feel like I'm ready for something more. And so that's what's next over there. And then in terms of what's next to my job, I don't really think about it. I'm happy doing what I'm doing. And in terms of ambition, other than getting this book out, I mean, one of the things about this is really kind of a focus on, I haven't talked very much about, is focus on creativity. I feel like everybody is creative in some way, and it's important to share your creativity with the world and express your creativity. The book is kind of, for me, just creative output, and that's exciting. And then one of my goals in the future is to actually have a show of my paintings and get my painting to a place where I feel like
That's
ready.
Awesome.
It's ready to show.
I loved your book, Take Off Your Shoes, and I love the name of it. It's so great. And I hope everybody rushes out to buy the book. Thank you so much for being with us today. I so appreciate it.
Oh, I've really had a good time. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and congratulations on everything.
Thank you.
Thanks so much to Ben for being on Untangle today. His book, Take Off Your Shoes, is available at all major booksellers. If you have feedback or suggestions for guests, email me at patricia@meditationstudioapp.com. And if you have a minute, will you subscribe to our podcast and give us a rating? Every rating helps as well. I hope you'll download Meditation Studio in the App Store. We'll see you next time.